offense. That was an enormous difference.
It was unmistakable. Defense spending in the West soared. Cruise and Pershing II missiles were deployed in Western Europe. The American Air Force and Navy stepped up spying and probing operations right at the edge of Soviet borders. The CIA, under the new leadership of the irascible old Cold Warrior Bill Casey, launched an aggressive operation to force the Soviet adventure in Afghanistan onto the defensive. Within the Soviet Empire, Poland's Solidarity Trade Union received special CIA donations and equipment. The superpower balance began to tilt. So how did the aging Soviet leadership react, now under Yuri Andropov, former head of the KGB? Oleg Kalugin, a former KGB general himself, currently enjoying capitalist business adventures in his old target city of Washington.
One day we received a cable from Moscow, urgent, signed by Andropov. And in effect it said that at no time after World War II, the Soviet Union and the West were closer to another war. And for that reason, he said, because of the United States government and its Western allies now preparing for a major military or aggressive act, which was not specified, we must be fully mobilized, and the intelligence and counterintelligence services and all the military now on full alert.
But Andropov was a sensible man, former head of the KGB, now first secretary. You must have been stunned when you got that. You must have thought, what on earth is going on?
It was truly based on fear. The Soviet Union at the time was slowly degenerating. So this kind of hysteria was a reflection of the Soviet assessment of the Western potential and our lack of that ability to follow and compete with them.
And it got worse for Moscow. By the spring of 1983, President Reagan was telling Americans,
what if free people could live secure in the knowledge that their security did not rest upon the threat of instant U.S. retaliation to deter a Soviet attack, that we could intercept and destroy strategic ballistic missiles before they reached our own soil or that of our allies?
The Strategic Defense Initiative, dubbed Star Wars, was a trillion-dollar plan to make the U.S. invulnerable to a nuclear attack. This plan, seen from Moscow, seemed to spell the end of the policy of nuclear deterrence which had maintained a balance of terror and peace for over 30 years. Furthermore, it was a system the Soviets could match with neither technology nor hard cash. They began to panic. Arms talks with the Americans were abandoned. And then,
while they preach the supremacy of the state, declare its omnipotence over individual man, and predict its eventual domination of all peoples on the earth, they are the focus of evil in the modern world.
The temperature of the Cold War dropped below freezing. And then,
Washington has accused the Soviet Union of shooting down the South Korean airliner which disappeared overnight off northern Japan. The State Department says the Boeing 747 was brought down with a missile and a Russian pilot.
The U.S. reaction from Ambassador to the UN Jean Kirkpatrick was calculated and revealing.
Quite simply, the Soviets decided to shoot down a civilian airliner, shot it down, murdering the 269 persons on board, and lied about it.
Now began a remarkable period in Soviet post-war history, a moment completely missed or misread by the CIA. Convinced by all these events that the Americans were preparing for war, the Soviets in turn launched Operation Rian to look for signs that the West was about to launch a nuclear first strike. This is how an increasingly paranoid Soviet leadership briefed its KGB spies at the Washington Residency. Yuri Shvets.
There were guys in our residency whose job was every night to drive around. One guy was driving around Pentagon, another guy was driving around the State Department, the White House, etc., the key government institution, and to watch how many lights are on. If there are too many lights, unusually many lights, that was supposed to be a signal. I remember one day we received a circular cable from Moscow, meaning that it went out to all major stations, saying, look guys, this is how you should work on Brian. And they quote this particular episode, when the London station reported to center that the British government announced a recruitment of donors to donate blood. So the station reported to Moscow that we believe this is a part of the preparation of the British government for the nuclear war, as a part of Grand program. And the head of the service, Khrushchev, said they knew that they would be preparing for this kind of war. And this is the proof. So this is a vicious circle.
So perfectly ordinary activities like seeking new blood donors suddenly assumed the most menacing interpretations. The FBI, who shadowed the known KGB officers, was baffled by this new and seemingly pointless touring of Washington by night, such as here at the Pentagon. And then in November 1983, a military exercise called Able Archer, unfortunately timed, took NATO forces through the full-scale simulated release of nuclear weapons. Seen from Moscow, the dots were now joining up, suggesting the nightmare of war. But what really lay behind this perception?
The paranoia was by itself pretty much dangerous, because any margin of error of assessment of this paranoia by itself could lead to a disaster. Had the Soviet leadership during the time of Cuban Missile Crisis had the same kind of paranoia they had in the 80s, I believe the outcome of the missile crisis in 62 could have been absolutely different.
So do you believe that the CIA should have programmed into its analysis the extent of Soviet paranoia in the 80s?
I don't think they understood that.
But the British did have an idea of what was happening, thanks to a very high-level defector in place recruited by MI6 in Copenhagen. Colonel Oleg Gordievsky, who rose to number 3 at the London residency, knew exactly what the Kremlin leadership was doing and thinking. Through his British handlers, the Americans were tipped off. Even then, as top CIA Soviet analyst Fritz Ehrmacht now recalls, the agency still didn't get it right.
We posed ourselves this question. Are they gearing up for some military initiative that they know carries the risk of war and are therefore preparing for it? Or are they acting out of fear that we are gearing up for some sort of a challenge that could lead to war, and they need to preempt that, at least in a defensive sense? And we came to the conclusion, no, they're not doing either. They are not doing what the cookbook, you know, how the Warsaw Pact forces were supposed to behave in peacetime and supposed to behave as they prepared for war. They're not doing what the cookbook calls for them to do, and they would be doing it if they were genuinely fearful that their own actions or our actions would provoke a war.
No intelligence cookbook could give the right recipe for dealing with an irrational outbreak of paranoia in the Soviet Union. Oleg Gordievsky, the British KGB asset whose work for Western intelligence was to earn him a personal invitation to visit President Reagan, was struck by the persistence of outmoded thinking at CIA headquarters.
When I started to visit the CIA, beginning of 86, and we discussed the Soviet strategy and the nuclear armaments and so on, they were still not persuaded I was right about all what I was saying, about paranoia and about the belief the United States would have a sudden nuclear attack. And one important analyst told me it was a huge deception plan by the Soviet leadership to deceive us. So they were so deeply rooted in their own dogmas of the previous time, when they received fresh and different information which clashed with their dogmas, they didn't like it. They were not flexible enough.
But they did finally get the message, and the war scare ended with messages of reassurance sent through traditional back-channel communications between Washington and Moscow. Now the biggest political tsunami since World War II was about to erupt. And where was the CIA? Mel Goodman, the agency's seasoned Kremlinologist.
The proudest achievement at the CIA in my 20 years was, yes, I was out in front in recognizing that Mikhail Gorbachev was different, that he was conducting a strategic revolution, that Edward Shevardnadze was a foreign minister like no other. It's a very sad aspect because a lot of this was reporting I could never get out of the CIA building because it was stopped for political reasons.
So you are writing memoranda to whoever saying there's something different happening here. There's something quite
cataclysmic in a way going on in the Soviet Union. Gorbachev is not out of the same style, out of the same mold. And these memoranda were being blocked.
When you think about it, the central question of our time, all of us in our generation, was Soviet policy changing and was Gorbachev for real? And on those key questions, the key questions of our time, upper management of the CIA was wrong and the small group of us had it right.
And Dick Kerr, reflecting a problem that has endured to this day at the agency, believes the CIA consistently focused on the close-up and ignored the bigger picture.
We get enamored with individuals and sometimes forget that the institutions and the people surrounding those individuals are more important, because we like to deal with a person better than we like to assess an institution as such.
In not making the correct assessments of Soviet institutions, the CIA inevitably failed in one of its key tasks, the correct interpretation of the superpower's military strength and efficiency, a prime intelligence target. The annual Moscow May Day parades of military might were deceptive. Then a unique opportunity for the CIA to see for itself occurred, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Milt Bearden, the tough CIA station chief, personally organized Mujahideen opposition to the invasion. He crossed the border many times. What he saw for himself weren't the triumphs of the much-touted and highly geared Soviet military machine. He saw an army that couldn't even defeat mountain men with flintlocks and old sandals.
I don't think anything that CIA could have said which would have sounded as follows. By the way, you know, the Soviet Union is really just barely above third world level, Mr. President. You don't have to spend all this money that you're spending to prepare to engage them. Who's going to do that? Nobody did that.
Even though it was the truth?
I'm not sure people believed it was the truth. And the reason I tell you that is because when I started sending dispatches from Afghanistan saying, you know, in many ways the army that I seem to be lined up against over here, the much-vaunted Soviet army, looks pretty third world to me. Almost nothing works. So I'm sending this stuff back, and I'm getting, you know, from the Soviet analytical side of the house, and thing, like, who does he think he is?
Is it that they didn't really want to hear that news?
I don't think they believed it.
They didn't believe it. Of course, even Gorbachev had misjudged the power of the changes he'd unleashed, but then he wasn't running the CIA. Those who were simply couldn't imagine that after half a century of eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation, the Soviets would blink and retreat into history without firing a shot at the West. Dick Kerr, with hindsight, half forgives that failure.
What we did not understand, nor did I think Gorbachev understand, was the impact of this political change would have on the Soviet Union. The fact that Gorbachev would actually take steps to destroy the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and the implications of that political change, I don't think we saw them in advance.
It wasn't so much a failure of intelligence collection and analysis as a failure of imagination.
I think that's probably a fair comment, although early on, if we would have, say in the mid-80s, we would have said the Soviet Union was in the process of breaking up. I think people in the administration and elsewhere with some cause would have said, you have flights of imagination.
What do they think? What do they know? There's no getting away from Herb Meyer's dictum. The lack of sound human intelligence sources, HUMINT, has dogged the CIA throughout its history. Ultimately, the agency failed in the definitive test of thinking itself into the mind of its target and anticipating events. And there was a corollary. The obsession with the communist threat over so many years distorted its intelligence gathering elsewhere in the world with profoundly damaging consequences. That's what I'll be examining in the next program.
Spies Are Us, a history of the CIA, was presented by Tom Mangold. The editor is Maria Belinska. Yes. Spies Are Us, A History of the CIA, presented by Tom Mangold. Program 2, Losing Friends and Influencing No One.
Vietnam is a clear example that the intelligence can be spot on, but if the policymakers are not reading it or not paying attention to it, it doesn't matter what frequency the intelligence community is on.
In Iran, the CIA were not a neutral observer, and they had something at stake. And the stake was their relationship with the Shah and his regime that was extremely important to them. They simply were not prepared to sit back and look at it objectively.
Vietnam and Iran, two examples of how the CIA lost the intelligence game despite being right in the first case and plain wrong in the second. In Vietnam, the CIA's customers at home just didn't want to hear what the agency was saying. In Iran, the CIA was too myopic to see the truth, with profound consequences for America's understanding of Islamic fundamentalism. In this week's program in my series on CIA history, I'm going to show just how and why these errors occurred, and why these failures still stalk Washington's policymakers to this day. We begin with America's disastrous involvement in Vietnam, famously described in fiction by Graham Greene.
We've got to contain communism, or what they call communism.
What could be done, what should be done, what he thought, what he'd read. He made me remember there was a time when I had wanted to make a difference.
What is it? To watch liberty snuffed out?
Liberty is a very Western word. How do you define it for the Vietnamese?
By giving people the freedom to choose.
Okay, you give them the freedom to choose, they vote and they elect Ho Chi Minh. Things are more complicated than they seem.
The conventional view of the CIA in Saigon. Quiet Americans, naive, blundering, bamboozled. But Graham Greene's judgment was far too harsh. What he didn't know at the time was that whenever the CIA was right in its assessments, it was cold-shouldered by its political masters at home.
The worst thing you can do with intelligence, from my perspective at least, is to be ignored by your policymakers.
Dick Kerr, former deputy director of Central Intelligence. His career at CIA goes back to 1960, as the communists in North Vietnam began to fight to reunite the North with the Catholic capitalist South.
There is on a regular basis information that in effect says to the president, if he's sensitive, your policy's not working. Intelligence is saying, we're assessing what's happening on the ground, the object of your policy, and it's not happening the right way. In fact, it may be doing exactly opposite of what you want.
Would the best example of this be Vietnam, where the agency, one is told, consistently warned the president that this war would go on much longer than he wanted it to go on, that it was unwinnable in the short term, that mistakes were being made. Is that a good example of what you're saying?
It is. It's probably the most unfortunate example of a disconnect between the policy and the intelligence assessing the implications and the actions as a result of that policy.
By the 1960s, there had indeed been a loss of synchronization between the decision-makers in government and the CIA. Washington believed that if Vietnam fell to the communists, so would the whole region. Remember the domino theory?
The loss of Vietnam would trigger the loss of Southeast Asia and conceivably even the loss of India, and would strengthen the Chinese and the Soviet position across the world.
Robert McNamara, Kennedy's and Johnson's Secretary of Defense, the administration's hard man on foreign policy. Now, the domino theory was a seductive philosophy here in Washington. It was one that kept the Pentagon budgets flowing and squared with the conventional wisdom of Soviet attempts at world domination.
When I was training in the agency to go to Vietnam, I was hit over the head with the domino theory. I was told it was what would define the future of South Vietnam. The ideology that propelled us into the war obscured history. And it was obviously a terrible oversight, because in embracing the domino theory, we perpetuated our presence there. We justified staying in.
Frank Snepp was principal analyst for the CIA on North Vietnam from the late 60s. The CIA realized that the domino theory was seriously flawed. The agency understood that the presentation of the Vietnamese as communists, pure and simple, was superficial and wrong. Ray McGovern was its top specialist on the international communist movement.
They were Marxists through and through, but nationalists first, I would say. And there's a big difference. In other words, if they were traditional Marxists, as we looked at the, quote, international communist movement in those days, they would be subservient to, or at least susceptible to, influence from Moscow and from Beijing. These fellows were independent.
The truth is that in Vietnam, the CIA had good human intelligence sources, ran productive networks, and worked well with the U.S. special forces behind enemy lines. But its intelligence take on the number of communist troops on the ground and their state of weaponry flew in the face of inflated Pentagon claims. The CIA also disproved alarming assertions that the North Vietnamese were receiving massive support from communist China and the Soviet Union. General Brent Scowcroft, later National Security Advisor to two presidents at the White House, spent much time on Vietnam while based at the Pentagon in the early 70s, and recalls the damage done to American policy by the disconnect between CIA and Pentagon.
Well, there was a great deal of unrealism about Vietnam. In the first place, we were never crystal clear about what our objectives were, what would constitute success, and what would be required to achieve success, and the intelligence estimates played into all that. And my recollection is you're right, that in retrospect, the agency proved to be fairly accurate in its assessment of supplies coming in and the strength of the Viet Cong and so on and so forth. But it was not welcome news, and the Pentagon frequently like to characterize the CIA as being inhabited by a bunch of left-wingers who didn't really understand the nature of communism.
That was wonderfully ironic for the CIA as it faced mounting criticism from the radical left throughout the world for its perceived role in stoking the Vietnam War.
Come on, mothers throughout the land, pack your boys off to Vietnam. Come on, fathers, don't hesitate, send your sons off before it's too late. Be the first one on your block, have your boy come home in a box. And it's one, two, three, what are we fighting for?
The truth is, when young reporters such as myself arrived to cover the war, we found a well-informed CIA and expert agent runners in place. The military men, on the other hand, spent only a year in country, insufficient time to understand their enemy, both regular troops and the Viet Cong or VC. When they reported that the enemy was 6 feet tall, they were cleverly stroking Washington. But that's not the more complex enemy that John Sullivan, a CIA polygraph examiner working in Vietnam in the early 70s, came across.
We got a radio message to pick up a VC prisoner that had just been captured. We landed in a mangrove swamp in a place called Gokong, and there were two American GIs with this emaciated, gaunt, wounded VC. He was about 5 feet 7 inches tall. He couldn't have weighed 100 pounds. He was obviously starved. He had his hands tied behind his back. He had a blindfold on, but tears were running down his face. Little shrapnel wounds all over him. And my thought at that point was, we have been fighting these people for 20 years. This is the enemy. And the contrast between him and his two American captors, who looked the picture of health, well-equipped, well-dressed. And I said, Lord, if we haven't done it by now, we're not going to do it.
Now, John, you are, with respect, a fairly humble CIA officer in Saigon Station. If this message gets through to you, and you can see this, why didn't the message get through to your chief of station, and why didn't it get through to Washington and Langley?
Oh, I think it got through, but it was ignored.
Their objective is not the fulfillment of Vietnamese nationalism. It is to erode and to discredit America's ability to help prevent Chinese domination over all of Asia.
There was by now a serious breach between President Lyndon Johnson's White House and the CIA's view of America's engagement in Vietnam. But Washington doggedly clung to its position. The trouble was, if the CIA was right, if the northern forces were smaller than originally estimated, if the movement was more nationalist than communist, and if there was no Moscow gold, then much of the politico-military case for the war simply collapsed. George Allen spent 16 years with the CIA working on Vietnam.
The agency was focused on the kind of war that it really was. That is, a Mao Zedong type People's Liberation War. And we targeted what we were doing against that particular war.
Now, my understanding is that you didn't say to Washington, this war is unwinnable. You just said it could take much, much longer than you imagine. And it's going to be much more of a knockdown, drag-out fight. What did you then feel when you saw more and more United States troops being brought into Vietnam?
It was very discouraging and very demoralizing. Most of the people I worked with saw it as turning the nature of the war into one where it would appear that we were attempting to impose our colonial rule over the country. It appeared to us it was playing right into the hands of the enemy. Most of the Vietnamese people we talked to challenged us, asking us, what is it you're trying to do?
We'll say for as long as it takes, we shall provide whatever help is required to win the battle against the communist insurgents.
By now, Washington was witnessing a self-fulfilling prophecy. As thousands more American troops flooded into the country and U.S. bombers struck Hanoi, the conflict did take on the appearance of an old-fashioned colonial struggle. The more American military might poured into the country, so the insurgents from the south, and later the more disciplined battalions from the north, fought even harder. To make matters worse, the CIA, while determined to protect the front of the building, made the mistake of leaving the back door ajar. South Vietnamese politicians who'd been carefully groomed for power by the CIA felt increasingly exposed and neglected. Frank Snepp, CIA, Saigon.
Our intelligence on the communists was sensational. Our intelligence on our allies was terrible. And the main reason was that we didn't want to look too closely at the creature we had created. We sponsored the careers of a number of South Vietnamese officials. We ensured that they moved up the hierarchy and they reported to us. Having done that, we never wanted to turn around and say, wait a minute, is it possible that one or more of these people are also serving the communists? There was an estimate done by a CIA analyst, I believe in 1971, that posited from all sorts of captured documents and other indices that there were probably 14,000 communist spies spread through the South Vietnamese government structure and its outposts in the countryside. That was an extraordinary number and a terrible admission to ourselves because we were looking at Vietnamization, we were looking to turn the war over to the South Vietnamese, and if the government was about as porous as Swiss cheese, how could you possibly do it?
America's position became increasingly untenable, and just as the CIA had predicted, the military could no longer hold the line against a once friendly population.
CIA men and MPs have gone into the embassy and are trying to get the snipers out by themselves.
The siege of the American embassy in Saigon, the undignified flight from the south, it's all history now. But that sorry endgame reflected unfairly on the CIA. The irony is that having got it right, the CIA first had to endure rejection of its work by its major customers at home, and then stand by as its predictions came to pass. Some lessons must have been learned. Should one try to tell the White House what it doesn't want to hear? Will the truth set you free or simply exclude you from the inner circle? Is it wise to challenge a powerful institution like the Pentagon? The CIA left Vietnam sadder and wiser. Iran, on the periphery of the Soviet Union, was to illustrate a different truth. A major oil producer and strategically cited, it was a pivotal nation not to be allowed to topple under communist influence. Here the CIA worked well with and not against the policymakers. And here, unlike Vietnam, the CIA's vision of true Western interests in the region turned out to be astigmatic and wrong. In 1953, Washington determined it should place its own man in power in Iran. The CIA helped engineer and finance its first ever coup, which displaced the popular radical nationalist leader Dr. Mossadegh and replaced him with the pro-West anti-communist Shah.
I feel very strongly that the operation was a success. It was a success because it has to be viewed in the context of the Cold War. Iran was one of the targets that was about to be gobbled up, if you will, by the Soviets. Our objective was a Cold War objective of containment, of keeping the Soviets out of Iran, and what we therefore did was buy time.
John Waller was the first CIA officer to be based in Iran and a key figure in the coup. The CIA's meddling produced a quarter of a century of political calm to Iran and gave the United States a perfect platform to spy on Soviet installations. Surely an agency triumph. Mel Goodman, one of the CIA's top Soviet analysts.
No, it was a terribly unsuccessful operation because you had got the removal of a somewhat democratic government followed by this incredible Persian tyrant in the form of the Shah.
Yeah, but he was our tyrant.
Exactly, he was our tyrant. And that's what President Kennedy used to say about tyrants in Central America when we were very hypocritical about democratic reform, just as we were hypocritical about democratic reform in the Islamic countries. We would rather have a tyrant on our side than to take our chances with democracy in certain places. In Iran, it led to the Shah, which led directly to one of the largest CIA corporate intelligence failures, which was the failure to anticipate the coup against the Shah in 1979.
You develop these relationships with countries in pursuit of your own national interest, and it takes place in the context of the world in which you're operating.
Robert Gates, director of Central Intelligence, the CIA boss in the early 90s.
We dealt with some pretty lamentable regimes during the course of the Cold War because they were the lesser evil than the ones sitting in Moscow. Looking back, it's easy to say, well, you should never have had that kind of a relationship with this or that leader. The clarity of those decisions wasn't exactly there at the time they were being made.
But that realpolitik view of the CIA's behavior in Iran made sense only for those who saw Iran solely through the prism of the Cold War. Unlike the brutal honesty of its reporting in Vietnam, the CIA ran its Iranian operation without a broader international perspective, ignoring the Shah's growing repression of internal dissent. Frank Snepp was both an operative and an analyst during his CIA career and sees parallels between what happened in Vietnam and in Iran.
Once having installed our favorite in power and supported him there, we never wanted to look very closely at his weaknesses. We surrounded our favorite with officers we thought we could trust, and we didn't look at the rising opposition. One of the reasons in Vietnam we never did that was that every time we did, we caused our allies to tremble in their boots. They thought we were looking for some alternative to the government that they provided us. Same thing happened in Iran. We also became, as time went on and technology improved, so dependent on satellite photography, on radio intercepts to give us some sense of what was happening on the ground, true in Vietnam, true in Iran. We didn't develop the assets that would have gone into the field. When I say assets, I'm talking about agents, informants. We became language shy, and we just weren't close to the targets. It proved fatal in Vietnam because we didn't see how weak our allies were. And in Iran, what happened was that we didn't see and wouldn't allow ourselves to see how strong feelings were at the rice roots or grassroots level.
The golden rule, the need for human intelligence, was being ignored. The agency failed to hear the drumbeat of something new and powerful emerging from the mosques of Tehran. And in Paris, an exiled religious leader called Ayatollah Khomeini was attracting worldwide attention. The sleeping giant of Islamic radicalism was beginning to stretch and flex. Where was the CIA? Not where it should have been, in the tea rooms and sweaty bazaars of Tehran, but comfortably inside the perfume palace and far too close to their man on the peacock throne, the Shah of Iran. This is President Carter singing from the CIA hymn sheet as late as 1979.
Iran, because of the great leadership of the Shah, is an island of stability in one of the more troubled areas of the world. This is a great tribute to you, Your Majesty, and to your leadership, and to the respect and the admiration and love which your people give to you.
The CIA came to be immensely dependent on the Shah, not just to tell them what was going on in Iran, but because that was not seen as a very big problem.
Dr. Gary Sick, President Carter's man on the National Security Council responsible for Iranian affairs.
The Shah was regarded as being on top of things, very much in control, not under threat at all, and so the internal politics didn't seem to be that interesting or exciting. But the Shah was prepared to cooperate very actively with regard to intelligence on the Soviet Union. We had several big sites located in Iran, secret sites that tracked missile development in the Soviet Union. And to keep track of regional affairs, the cooperation between the Shah and the station chief in Iran was very, very close. So the station chief basically had an appointment to see the Shah on a regular basis, like once a week. And they had a long, detailed discussion and an exchange of information in which, you know, the CIA found this to be just an extraordinarily useful relationship. And as a result, they were probably the last who were willing to admit that something terrible was going on here when the Shah started to fall. They were far, far behind the game.
This has been the day of the revolution. The people seized control from the Shah's government and all it stood for. Army barracks were plundered and guns distributed almost like confetti. They toppled statues of the Shah and sent soldiers and police running for their lives. The atmosphere was euphoric. In one fell swoop, it seemed, Iran had become an Islamic republic.
While everything is easy with hindsight, that intelligence agencies are paid for their foresight. They have a weak defense if that fails, and the CIA did fail to anticipate the potential of a powerful new movement, one that would change the face of politics in the region and then beyond. And there was a further problem for the agency with its customers back home. Did the executive arm of government here in Washington really want to hear that its Iranian policy was failing? Now, in one sense, this mirrored the CIA's Vietnam dilemma. When I went to see Admiral Stansfield Turner, who was director of Central Intelligence during the overthrow of the Shah's regime, he was remarkably frank about the unwisdom of playing Cassandra to one's political masters.
For us in the intelligence world to have gone to the president and said, we think Iran is about to crumble, would have been a major change in U.S. policy. It's hard for anybody to go that much against the opinion that has built up in this country as to what the relationship with Iran would be. And in addition, there's the danger in our country that if you start that kind of a thought around, it will leak out. And it will become a really major issue of relationships with a country like Iran.
But Admiral, if I read you correctly, what you're saying here is quite unusual, that even if you had had the intelligence, you would have been too wary of, possibly frightened of, the policymakers and the executive to tell them the truth.
No, I'm trying to say that to come to the conclusion that this was the truth would have been very difficult, because it would have been running so contrary to the tide of opinion about what our relationship with Iran was.
Admiral Turner, admitting that there were moments when the CIA found discretion the diplomatic substitute for valor, thus ignoring the agency's own motto, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." The result was a policy catastrophe for the United States. The political dividend for Washington was deep humiliation, as American citizens, including CIA officers, were taken hostage. And as the revolution overwhelmed the country, the agency even failed to shred its secret papers properly. One major reason for the debacle, according to Roel Markgerecht, who worked on the Iranian desk at the agency after the Islamic Revolution, was that the CIA's recruiting policy had failed.
The general understanding in the agency was, as one senior officer put it to me, who was in fact an Iran desk chief and later became a chief of the Near East Division, is that a good case officer can go anywhere. So he actually referred to officers as being peripatetic. The cultural differences shouldn't prevent them from serving all over the world.
How is it possible to work undercover as a covert operator without first hosing yourself down with the language and the culture of the target country?
That's an excellent question. You would think it would be a bit surreal.
Has it changed?
No.
A bleak inquest on an intelligence failure and the gloomy prediction that the lessons have still not been learned. CIA station chiefs comfortable with submitting routine political reports to head office, always through the prism of Soviet communism, simply didn't foresee that a new non-communist force had entered the political scene. Gary Sick, formerly of the National Security Council.
There was no Islamic fundamentalism, for all practical purposes, before Iran. I mean, this was the first major manifestation of Islamic fundamentalism, of Islamic politics, Islamism. It was not something we were familiar with at all. So the whole concept was new and radical and required a serious shift of thinking. And a friend of mine said to me at the time, you know, whoever took religion seriously? You dealt with politics, and religion really had very little to do with that. Now that sounds incredibly naive, but at the time, it was not part of the tool chest of American or other observers in the region. We were simply beginning to discover that religion could, in fact, be used for political purposes and could have major political consequences.
But it took 22 years for the penny to drop all the way. Then it was too late. The full force of religion and politics struck on September the 11th, 2001. Next week, in the last of my series, I'll be looking at the agency post 9/11 and particularly at some of the moral issues that have arisen now that the CIA has been given a license to kill.
Spies Are Us, a history of the CIA, was presented by Tom Mangold. The editor is Maria Belinska. Spies Are Us, a history of the CIA. Presented by Tom Mangold. Program 3. To kill is to survive.
We've got to have the best intelligence we can possibly have. And my report to the nation is, we've got the best intelligence we can possibly have thanks to the men and women of the CIA.
I have no problem whatsoever suggesting that we need the capability and should use it against certain really bad people who have demonstrated their evilness and their capacity for evilness.
September the 11th, nearly 2 years ago. 2,795 people dead, the greatest American intelligence failure since Pearl Harbor. The Central Intelligence Agency was formed precisely to ensure that kind of surprise attack didn't succeed again. Yet at this very moment of failure, the CIA rises from the ashes of disaster by finding a new role. The agency is going into the killing business. Jeffrey Smith is the former general counsel of CIA.
The United States has a prohibition on assassinations, which is contained in an executive order initially signed by President Ford in 1975 and continued by every president since then. I believe very firmly that the United States should retain a ban on assassinations. Having said that, I do believe it is appropriate to use lethal force against certain individuals and groups of individuals when the United States has clear and convincing intelligence information that that individual has engaged in armed attacks against Americans. It is, in a sense, no different from what we did during World War II when we shot down Admiral Yamamoto, who planned and commanded the attack on Pearl Harbor.
The CIA's failure to predict and warn of the World Trade Center attacks should have led to a root and branch investigation of its structure and methods. Instead, under the shrewd leadership of George Tenet, the CIA was manipulated into indispensably the right place at the right time, offering the right service. In this third and last program of my series about the CIA, I'll be looking at the agency in the new millennium. I'll be exploring its controversial new paramilitary role and the ethics of what it's doing.
What went wrong with America's intelligence system? 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and this is a special report from NPR News. Our first caller is Bill, who joins us on the line from San Jose in California.
It seems to me like we've devoted this incredible amount of money, and in this case, in this instance, it hasn't done us a darn bit of good.
Let's go now to Pascal, who joins us from North Bergen, New Jersey.
I wonder whether somebody's going to look very carefully at whether or not some of these people did not do their job. And
Tom joins us now from Salt Lake City, Utah.
The American people are the employers of the CIA and the FBI, and I think it's time that they appointed new guards for their future security.
The visceral American reaction to the CIA's failure on Al-Qaeda. The man in the street has a point. There had been clear warning signals that radical fundamentalist Islamic terror groups were on the move all over the world. It had begun with a terror attack on the U.S. Marine base in Beirut in 1983. Then,
there's a growing feeling in New York that yesterday's explosion at the World Trade Center was caused by a bomb. The state governor, Mario...
The United States and Saudi Arabia have vowed to hunt down the terrorists responsible for the bomb attack on an American military base at Dhahran in eastern Saudi Arabia.
Around 50 people have been killed in bomb attacks on two American embassies in East Africa. Most of the casualties...
At least four American sailors have been killed in an apparent attack on a U.S. destroyer in the Yemeni port of Aden. More than 40...
It was the CIA's job to join up the dots. It failed to do so. For senior politicians, such as President Reagan's former National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane, the evidence of a substantial intelligence failure is compelling.
The agency certainly had an obligation when these real problems began to be manifest. Not long after the Taliban arrived, of Afghanistan being the number one drug producer in the world, and the emergence of this terror menace. Bear in mind now that we've had an attack on the World Trade Center in 93, Khobar Towers, two embassies in East Africa, and ultimately the coal. But all these are coming at you at USA Today in the front page of a newspaper and CNN, and it might have occurred to someone, you know, we probably ought to have some more people on the ground over there to tell us at least who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. But there was no first apparent recognition of that threat to our national interest and reaction to deploy the resources, primarily human collection, to equip us with the relevant information and provide the fact basis for a policy of dealing with it.
The CIA, while obviously aware of the problems of international terrorism, approached the issue in a curiously conventional way. Attacks on U.S. interests overseas, while lamentable, didn't necessarily pose a domestic homeland threat. Nor had the CIA addressed the evilness of the new terrorists. These weren't groups, like the IRA, with whom one could try to negotiate in good faith. These men and women killed their enemies simply because they hated them. Nor were they frightened of killing themselves. End of discussion. Furthermore, that old CIA bogey, the failure to penetrate target groups, gather primary source intelligence from human beings, had still not been confronted. The agency tended to see events through the mirror image of how America would behave and react in similar circumstances. Dick Kerr was number two at CIA in the late 80s and early 90s.
I think the recognition of terrorism as an issue of real importance following the breakup of the Soviet Union was there. Did we put enough people on it? Did we have enough focus on it? And I think the answer is no, we did not. my own perspective of that is there's also a policy element involved in this. That is, I thought our policy reaction to the bombing of the barracks in Saudi Arabia, to the coal, and to the bombing of the embassies in Africa was very passive.
So in its defense, the CIA can justifiably point to policy decisions taken by an executive with its eye frequently off the ball. Had the United States' political reaction been more determined after the attacks on its embassies in East Africa and on the USS Cole in Yemen, a less ambivalent message might have been sent to al-Qaeda. And there was also the natural restraint imposed on the agency by the Congressional Intelligence Oversight Committees, whose job it was to guard the Guardians.
We were very, very slow to give up the blue sky peace dividend and say, folks, the world is really a dangerous place. It's dangerous in different ways.
Fortegoss, himself a former CIA officer, now Republican chairman of the House of Representatives Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence.
The intelligence community knew that, but we did a bad job of selling that, and I take some of the blame for that. I was not sufficiently persuasive in my job as the chairman to sound the warning alarms in a convincing way to get the investment we needed to keep our human intelligence up to the level it needed. And frankly, we shorted the budget.
Has 9/11 done the trick?
Oh, well, of course, it was night and day. It's walking into a dark room and turning on the light.
But sudden lights can blind without giving illumination. Aware of its persistent failure in collecting human intelligence material, the agency is currently scrutinizing its pension retirees list and recalling a dad's army of once skilled field and case officers, interrogators, and agent runners. These good old boys are euphemistically known as annuitants. Former Vietnam hand Dick Holm won't be playing bowls for the home team for a while. Despite having just published his memoirs, he's back in service. They need those special skills of his.
This is not a science, it's rather an art, because it deals with people, and each situation is a little different. You don't deal with an Iraqi camel driver the same way as you do with a Swiss banker. There are nuances involved, and it does take some experience to run through these things.
Will people like you be expected to go back on the road into the field?
People like me have, and I would be willing.
So at the age of 67, you would do agent running yourself?
I would.
Would you go to the Philippines tomorrow and deal with Islamic fundamentalism there and go out into the jungle?
Yes.
Since the 70s, the CIA has deliberately avoided recruiting agents with tarnished reputations or highly questionable backgrounds. Under intense political pressure, all that skullduggery came to an end. But 9/11 has reversed the policy.
The CIA must be able to recruit individuals with terrible human rights records and with criminal records. There is no way that the CIA can penetrate terrorist groups, al-Qaeda, without dealing with people who are part of the group.
Jeffrey Smith, formerly general counsel to the CIA and now a lawyer in private practice.
The judgment is made as to whether the value of the intelligence to be acquired outweighs the cost to the United States of dealing with some very bad people.
Any agent or any officer in the field will tell you, if you ask him that question, you're his departmental head, do the means justify the end? He will always say, this guy's going to give us the best take we've ever had. I'm advising you, Mr. Smith, we've got to put this man on our payroll. You never get an alternative answer because the name wouldn't have been submitted in the first place.
To be sure, the officer who initially recruits the source will be an advocate for recruiting the source. At the end of the day, we have to rely on the judgment of senior officers to make these judgments.
Trust me, I'm a CIA boss. But for troubled Main Street America, what's to be the role of congressional oversight of an agency that's quietly taking the gloves off to put a horseshoe round its knuckles? The CIA remains, in theory, heavily supervised by elected politicians. But as Congressman Portegoss has said, night has become day and the old rule book is gathering dust. What are the implications on the CIA's rapidly expanding operational side? Dick Kerr, former number two at the agency and still very much in the loop at Langley headquarters.
I would be a little concerned if we publicly announced or, as a matter of policy, abandon all the restrictions on intelligence collection. and abandon all of our restrictions on the kind of actions we were willing to take against individuals, not in wartime, but in peace. But I think you do need to have a lot more flexibility and creativity in how you operate against the terrorists. I don't think you can do it with kid gloves on, or I don't think you can get the information you need without using tactics that at times you would not be real comfortable with in a civilized society.
The delicate euphemisms flow. The truth is brutal. The CIA is moving into the killing fields as a paramilitary organization. The White House approves, and the Congress hasn't complained. It all began within a month of 9/11, when CIA boss George Tenet was the one man in the president's war cabinet who was able to offer immediate retaliation against the terrorists when George Bush wanted it. When the president called for boots on the ground to attack al-Qaeda bases in Afghanistan, it was Tenet who came up with a plan of action. It was a golden moment for the CIA, and Tenet seized it. His officers and agents would be armed by the Pentagon, even use some of their men, and use them without too many silly political restrictions. Mel Goodman, a 20-year veteran of the agency's analytical wing.
I was at a discussion that had an administration official present, and he was speaking, and he used an incredible word. He talked about the marriage between the Department of Defense and the Central Intelligence Agency. Well, nothing is more corrupting of what the CIA is all about than if there is such a thing as a marriage. I think there is certainly a partnership. President Harry Truman set up the CIA to be independent of this policy process. Now you have a CIA director, George Tenet, who came from the Hill. He was part of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who has tied his wagon to the Pentagon because he knows for political reasons the Pentagon has very high standing on the Hill and with American public opinion, whereas the Hill is extremely suspicious of the CIA, and I think even public opinion has turned against the CIA. I think George Tenet has seen, okay, our competitive advantage is paramilitary and covert operations, and the more we do for the Pentagon, the stronger we will become politically in this town.
The marriage worked well in Afghanistan. CIA officers and agents, armed to the teeth with bullets and trunks full of dollars, helicoptered across the ravaged country, buying new allegiances, taming warlords with cash, dealing forcefully with inconvenient people who didn't agree with Washington's view. By the time the Americans had put the Taliban to flight, no one could tell the difference between a CIA officer with a gun and a special forces counterpart. The campaign has been a triumph for the agency, but the glory comes at the cost of wandering into very dangerous territory. Congressman Porter Goss.
If you're talking covert action, you have to think in modern terms, and don't ask me for the exact job description of a covert action operator these days, because we haven't got one. We have recommended that we have one, and we're not quite there.
Would it be right to assume that one of the reasons why the CIA is out there now as a fighting force in many respects, and was in Afghanistan, is because the lines of communication are much shorter, the rules of engagement are different if they exist at all. It takes the Pentagon a long time to unwind and to strike. With the CIA, you don't have to do that. You see something, it's a target of opportunity, you go for it.
Well, you're exactly right. On every one of those points, I wouldn't quarrel with, and I would add one. The CIA wants to do the job. I'm not so sure the Pentagon does.
Are you effectively creating your own CIA SAS?
The answer to that is I personally hope so, but that is a job of selling that is not yet completed.
Porter Goss knows only too well what the SAS does best. It destroys and kills where necessary and in total secrecy. But the SAS, unlike the CIA, works to military law. As a civilian agency, the CIA is accountable through congressional oversight to answer for its actions. Only the top members of the executive and the Porter Gosses of this world will be privy to the life and death decision-making process. So how did the consultative process work on previous paramilitary strikes in Afghanistan and Sudan?
I received previous warnings of the missile strike on Afghanistan and the pharmaceutical factory after the embassies were blown up from the White House on secure communications, although I was actually on vacation at the time.
Was that post-hoc or were you consulted?
It was ahead of time.
And was it a consultative call?
Practically speaking, no. because there was virtually nothing I could have done. And I think the real reason the call came in was to satisfy the notification requirement, and secondly, to enlist my support, because obviously when that missile went up and came down, they were going to want to have somebody say, yeah, we knew about this.
That's right, but in a sense that might be the problem, because if that was a butt-covering exercise,